The headlines: at least 5 Israeli soldiers are injured, 3 critically, in a retaliatory attack by Palestinians after the regime launched deadly raid in the occupied West Bank. Drone attack on a military college in central Syria has left scores of casualties. And Germany is feared to be sliding back into a recession as exports of Europe's top economy fell for the second consecutive month in August.
Welcome to the studios here in the capital of Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us.
Israeli forces have killed 2 more Palestinians in their fresh raids on an area near the occupied West Bank town of Tulkarem. The victims have been identified as 23-year-old Abdul Rahman Atta and 27-year-old Adnan Mahmoud Faris. The 2 Palestinians were in a car near the village of Shufa in Tulkarem Governorate, where their vehicle came under Israeli live fire. Separately, Israeli forces have once again raided the Tulkarem refugee camp. The raid resulted in clashes between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians. According to Israeli media, 5 troopers were injured, 3 of them critically. Israel has intensified its attacks against Palestinians in recent months and has killed nearly 250 people, including children, in the West Bank this year. A correspondent, Mona Kandil, says that Israel has imposed curfew in a West Bank village after the killing of 2 Palestinians sparked clashes between locals and regime forces.
Clashes erupted between Palestinians in that area and the Israeli soldiers. However, Israeli military imposed a curfew at the Shufa village and surrounded the area where the illegal settlement is located. Later, the Israeli military issued a statement saying that during the military raid to Tulkarem and the nearby village of Shufa, at least 5 Israeli soldiers were wounded while Palestinians had detonated explosive devices into an Israeli military vehicle. It's not clear whether this incident took place while the assassination of the 2 Palestinians had been carried out or during exchange of fire that also took place several hours earlier, where Israeli troops had also raided Tulkarem before the early hours and the killing of the 2 Palestinians. Exchange of fire erupted, the clashes took place there, and the Israelis left the area, but later they again raided the Shufa village and Tulkarem refugee camp.
In Syria, multiple drones have targeted a crowded military academy in the central province of Homs, leaving dozens dead or injured. The attack targeted a graduation ceremony that held for cadets, attended by Syria's Defense Minister Ali Mahmoud Abbas and the Army Brass. Syria's Defense Ministry says a number of civilians observing the ceremony and a group of cadets were among those killed. Media reports say that at least 54 people lost their lives. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility for the terrorist attack, but the general command of the Syrian army blamed armed terrorist organizations supported by international parties for the, quote, unprecedented crime. The general command said that it will continue fighting those terrorist organizations and will bring the masterminds and perpetrators to account. The Syrian army is often targeted by terrorist groups, including Daesh and al-Qaeda. Part of a thermal power plant in Syria's northern city of Aleppo is back into operation with the help of Iranian companies.
Today we witnessed the launch of the first unit of Aleppo's thermal power plant with a capacity of 200 megawatts. It's an important achievement since power has been a big issue here, especially after U.S. forces occupied parts of Syria that produced the gas needed to run the power plants. The Americans smuggle Syrian gas and oil to other countries.
The launch was also attended by the Syrian Prime Minister Hossein Arnous. The minister underscored Syria's strategic relations with the Islamic Republic, which he said were to the interests of both nations. The project to revive the plant is part of an agreement between Damascus and Tehran to involve Iranian companies in the reconstruction of basic infrastructure in Syria. Iranian companies also helped prepare the 5th unit of the plant, bringing over 200 megawatts back to Aleppo's power grid. The plant, which has 5 units, produced more than 1,000 megawatts before being destroyed in the foreign-sponsored conflict. The passing out of a girl in a Tehran subway station has triggered a misinformation campaign by anti-Iran media outlets overseas.
16-year-old Armita Geravand fainted while boarding a train at a subway station in the Iranian capital. Immediately afterwards, anti-Iran TV channels and outlets embarked on a media campaign blaming the incident on the subway police. They accused the police of pushing Armita out of the train after a noisy argument leading to her fall. Now the Tehran subway company has released all camera footage from the moment Armita enters the station till she is taken to hospital. It's 6:52 a.m., October 1st. Armita enters the station alone. After 2 minutes, she passes the ticket control gate. At 6:54, she enters a grocery store in the station, and after that, she is seen heading to the platform, where she catches up with her friends. The whole 8 minutes of her presence in the station passes without a problem. Armita and her friends wait to board the train, but they don't take the first one. It seems they are waiting for a friend. Armita's arrival on the platform and her boarding take more than 8 minutes. Still no scene or any problem. Armita and her friends board the train, but after just 4 seconds, she gets dizzy and falls down. Her head hits the gap between the platform and the train. After Armita's fall, people on the scene call the emergency services and try to revive her. A couple of minutes into the incident, medical teams arrive and she's transported to the nearest hospital. Armita's close friends say there was no quarrel and it was simply a normal day to school.
Her head hit the gap between the train and the platform. I tried to pull her to safety with the help of others. When my hand touched her head, there was blood. We brought her out. Let me say this. Nothing happened on the train. No one pushed her. No one quarreled with her. Nothing. The moment she got on the train, she just fell.
Armita is now in hospital, and according to her medical report, she has gone through low blood pressure. Armita's parents say they have not seen any irregularities in the camera footage provided by the subway company or her medical report. They have called for people to pray for their daughter's health.
I've seen the subway footage, and I don't think what some people say is true. I've seen all the footage and followed it closely. Nothing was wrong.
Last year, similar media tactics employed by the anti-Iran news outlets incited violence throughout the country. Yet the misinformation campaign has only failed.
Bad news for Europe's top economy, Germany, as exports fell for the second consecutive month in August, adding to signs that the country is sliding back into a recession. Data from the Federal Statistics Agency show exports declined 1.2% in August compared to the previous month. Fellow Eurozone countries also experienced about 3% fall in exports in the same period. Meanwhile, imports ticked down also by 0.4%, down from what was expected. The German economy tipped into a recession at the start of the year and stagnated in the second quarter. High inflation, industrial slowdown, and a reduction in global demand for manufactured goods have all been weighing on the German economy. Some leading research institutes have already warned that the recession in the country this year will be worse than previously feared. France says it will begin withdrawing its troops from Niger this week, days after President Emmanuel Macron announced ending military cooperation with the West African country. In a statement, the French military headquarters said the troops will be pulled out in coordination with the Nigerians. France's relation with its former colony has remained tense since the military takeover of Niger in July. The junta also expelled France's ambassador to Niamey amid growing anti-French sentiments in the country. There are about 1,500 French troops in Niger deployed under the pretext of fighting terrorists across the Sahel region. But people have been demanding the withdrawal of French troops ever since their deployment. The French government's announcement to withdraw its forces from Niger marks the end of France's role in Africa. Political infighting in the U.S. House of Representatives has plunged Congress into deeper chaos. The lower chamber has voted to remove Speaker Kevin McCarthy. The Republican was dismissed in a vote triggered by a rare challenge from its own party. Republican Representative Matt Gaetz filed a motion to force a vote on removing McCarthy. Gaetz and a handful of allies criticized McCarthy for relying on Democratic votes to pass temporary funding that headed off a partial government shutdown.
Kevin McCarthy has been ousted as Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives in a brutal, historic rebellion by far-right Republicans. The rebellious GOP lawmakers, furious at his cooperation with Democrats, have accused him of a string of broken promises. This is the first ouster of a Speaker in the House's 234-year history.
On this vote, the yeas are 216, the nays are 210. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table. The office of Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives is hereby declared vacant.
I mean, it's a sign, I think, if history is any guide at all to this, it's a sign of a party in disintegration. I mean, that's what's happening, and it's melting down, and that's pretty clear. That's the older history. The more recent history, I think, is that what we're seeing today is the latest installment in the, you know, ever continuing coup d'etat by Donald Trump. I mean, that's what we're seeing.
The vote to oust McCarthy marks a major escalation in tensions for a House GOP conference that has been mired in infighting, and it comes just days after McCarthy successfully engineered a last-minute bipartisan effort to avert a government shutdown.
That I think probably the next step would be a shutdown, which is really what they're probably aiming for. They wanted to get McCarthy out of there in part because he stood in the way of that. Bunch of reasons, but that's part of it. And it's the politics of chaos.
The effort to oust the Speaker was led by GOP Republican Matt Gaetz. There is also a significant amount of distrust and anger from House Democrats towards McCarthy over his actions as Speaker and the House GOP agenda. The rebellious lawmakers accused McCarthy of a flip-flop, saying he had promised an end to hastily prepared stopgap legislation hammered out with the support of the opposition and a return to budgeting through the committee process. Some Republican leaders condemned McCarthy's removal, with former Vice President and current presidential candidate Mike Pence suggesting it would undermine the GOP in the eyes of voters. There is no clear successor to oversee the House Republican majority. Congress has just over 40 days to agree on a deal to avoid another potential government shutdown.
But there is a certain nihilistic quality to what they're doing. However, there is also, you know, genius in the madness, because the madness is about creating as much chaos as possible. And then, you know, then the Trump people will step in.
The dramatic ouster of U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has raised questions about the future of Washington's military assistance to Ukraine. That comes amid a widening divide within the Republican Party over the continuation of U.S. aid. The U.S. is by far the largest provider of military assistance to Ukraine.
Speaker Kevin McCarthy's ouster could signal a shift in the U.S. House of Representatives on aid to Ukraine, with some of his possible successors staunchly opposed to assisting Kiev. Republic opponents of the aid view it as excessive spending and a misplaced U.S. policy priority.
I rise to put the leadership of the House, the Senate, and the President of the United States on notice. I will not consent to any expedited passage of any spending bill that provides any more American aid to Ukraine. It's as if no one has noticed that we have no extra money to send to Ukraine. Our deficit this year will exceed $1.5 trillion. Borrowing money from China to send it to Ukraine makes no sense. It's not as if we have some sort of rainy day fund sitting around, trillions of dollars in a pot of money, and we're just going to send that to Ukraine. We're going to borrow it. When we borrow it and create new money to pay for that borrowing, we create the inflation that is plaguing our economy.
McCarthy earlier this week denied accusations by Gaetz that he had cut a secret deal with Biden to allow the House to vote on Ukraine aid. McCarthy said then he wanted more information from the Biden administration.
President Joe Biden asked Congress in July to approve another $24 billion related to Ukraine. Although the compromise struck in Congress dropped new fundings for Ukraine amid opposition from hardline Republicans, it remains unclear what might happen next. Biden and his Democratic Party say the U.S. has a duty to help Ukraine.
And why it's critically important for the United States and our allies that we keep our commitment. We can support Ukraine in the next tranche that we need, and there is another means by which we may be able to find funding for that, but I'm not going to get into that now.
However, the issue has become so politicized in Washington that the fate of vital military aid is now in jeopardy. The U.S. has approved four rounds of aid to Ukraine, totaling about $113 billion, with some of that money going towards replenishment of U.S. military equipment that was sent to the front lines.
Since the beginning of Russia's war in Ukraine, the American taxpayers provided Ukraine with $113 billion. Over the 583 days of war, between February 24, 2022, and the end of the month, that averages $6.8 billion per month, or $223 million per day. There's a lot of things that we need to fix in our country before we borrow money to try to perpetuate a war in another country.
There are also widespread concerns over corruption in Ukraine. The U.S. is increasingly urging Ukraine to do more to combat corruption. This is while Ukraine considers the direct budget support it gets from the U.S. and other foreign allies to be vital to keeping its economy afloat.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Multipolar resistance seeks only the restoration of sovereign equality and the democracy between nations. The U.S. regime should learn to live with the multipolar world. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. China Daily wrote, "Today global politics is likely to display more uncertainty. Apart from the Russia-Ukraine crisis, the sense of the next Cold War felt by international society will continue to serve a specter around the world unless the U.S. endless endeavors to contain China in the Asia-Pacific stops. The U.S. containment strategies are revealed in the form of AUKUS and QUAD, as well as the U.S. relentless seduction of some countries, especially of Southeast Asia, to provoke China on the South China Sea issue and Taiwan. Desiring the aspirations and ideals of a harmonized world may end up in vain since global actors, notably the U.S., are unwilling to create conducive conditions. Without this, it seems impossible to make the peace of the world a reality, until the U.S. can live with the pluralistic world. Citing Mearsheimer, the U.S. must concede the differences in the political system as the natural tendency of the universality of life as democracy taught people to tolerate divergence." Therefore, to get hold of harmony in global politics, the U.S. has to take these bold actions. Above all, the U.S. must respect other countries' sovereignty. Without appreciating sovereignty, the state will lose its significance. To date and throughout history, the U.S. has often annoyed and breached other countries' territory. Such actions were exemplified by its invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, and many other countries. If respecting other sovereign integrity is not respected by the U.S., then any country at any time can be targeted by the U.S. Thus, the self-restraint of the U.S. to not encroach on other sovereignty is the pillar that could avoid wars. Otherwise, it leads to instability and uncertainty. In addition, the U.S. should become sober now, admitting that global politics now is fraught with emerging powers, where the U.S. mightiness alone is declining. Hence, the U.S. should accept its new fate of regression with sincerity and let another actor have the chance to play the role and contribute to the multipolar world. Egoistic and arrogant attitudes should be discarded by the U.S. The global order must be maintained and navigated together. Since the desire to create a fair order is not only China's vision, but also all nations. Kanti Bajapi and Ivan Lacosma show in their paper Asian Conceptions of International Order that all Asians want a voice in the construction and maintenance of international order, including India, Indonesia, and other Asian states. It should be noted that, after becoming comfortable with the new form of multipolarity, surely the next step that the U.S. should take is to discontinue its old-fashioned provocations, including its interventions in other countries. In the dynamic world, change is unavoidable. International society is not a stagnant state and is changing persistently. It is heading and moving forward, and no force can deny the phenomenon. The U.S. decline and others' rise is something that every state must be in the agreement with. The obstinacy of the U.S. in preserving its privilege to control and rule the world arbitrarily may lead the world increasingly shaky. In conclusion, the idea of the Pillar of Peace is dependent on the acceptance of the U.S. of its relative decline, where the U.S. must stop its provocation of other countries. The U.S. must stop its proxy war to merely satisfy its ambition. The U.S. must open up much more space to the role of the rising economies. And importantly, the U.S. must accede to live with the multipolar world. Global Times also wrote, unipolarity has had a very short life. It became U.S. doctrine only after the end of the Cold War, when, in 1992, George H.W. Bush's administration asserted in a strategy document that America's political and military mission in the post-Cold War era will be to ensure that no rival superpower is allowed to emerge. This claim to power is wedded to the ideology of liberalism. U.S. primacy was declared to be essential to the future of freedom. Unipolarity was a rollback of the equal sovereignty of all nations envisioned by the UN Charter. It replaced collective internationalism with U.S. unilateralism and international law with the so-called rules-based order, a vague euphemism for the super-sovereign status of the U.S. It is the U.S. that is the revisionist power relative to the post-World War international order, while it is the non-Western world that seeks a restriction of that order. The unipolar world era was hastened to its end, not by enemies, but by the recklessness of the neoconservative policy program. The neocons continue to drive U.S. policy. The economic vehicle of unipolarity, neoliberal globalization, collapsed in the global financial crisis of 2008 and has been sustained without reform by money printing and debt creation. Global manufacturing, trade, diplomacy, and culture are already multipolar. This year, Beijing has emerged as the center of global diplomacy. The U.S. cannot dominate Russia or China militarily, despite having surrounded them with military bases. Liberalism, the ideology of a unipolar empire, has lost the legitimacy it once had around the world. Western countries' internal and international response to the COVID crisis was a disappointment. Meanwhile, China's development has demonstrated that there are other non-Western routes to modernity. Permanent war and financialization have also eroded the internal legitimacy of the Western elite and its ideology. Trust in Western leaders and institutional media is at an all-time low. The rise of political populism is a sign that the liberalism that buttressed the empire's claim to primacy is no longer unipolar, even at home. Its rhetoric is worn, its ideology is exhausted, and its legitimacy is questioned. The world is already multipolar. The multipolarist effort to give it shape through institutional collaboration is practical, not ideological. It aims to build the practical ability to resist U.S. coercion. As the U.S. weaponizes every economic relationship, institution, instrument, and technology, it has become necessary for any state intent on preserving its sovereignty to find alternatives. The most abused of these dependencies is the dominance of the U.S. dollar. We'll be right back.
Forbidden Files. Over 80% of the world's population uses a smartphone, but what over 80% of the world's population probably never thinks about is the true cost of the cobalt used in the batteries of smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. And today we're going to tell you a story of hands. Hands that have for long been hurt beyond imagination while harvesting the main ingredients to our industries. But before we start today's story, we need to properly set the scene, because though the country we're going to talk about is home to one of the poorest nations in the world, the land itself is perhaps the richest land on earth, or the country in question. The Democratic Republic of Congo, the country with the most abundant resources known on earth, and yet home to one of the 10 most impoverished nations in the world. But it was at the hands of these impoverished people that Europe experienced its industrial boom in the late 1800s. And it all started with some of the same trees that you saw in the picture, the rubber tree. From bicycle tires to industrial bands, rubber played a big role in answering Europeans' daily demands, especially with the rubber boom in the mid-1800s. But rubber does not grow in Europe. And that's where the story of a Belgian king and his Congo comes in. The story about the toil of hands and their unlikely reward. Now, who was this Belgian king we're talking about, and what did he do?
King Leopold II was born to the first royal family following Belgium's independence. He seized Congo with the help of the explorer Henry Morton Stanley in mid-1880s. The king and his forces drained the land of resources, killing elephants for ivory and cutting down trees for rubber. The United States became the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo. Congolese hands were systematically amputated during his rule. The severed hands were then collected and smoked by the colonists to be preserved for later counting and recording. King Leopold was responsible for the biggest genocide in history, with 10 to 15 million killed by torture, famine, and diseases, and many others systematically maimed. The king was honored with Great Britain's most prestigious title, a member of the Order of the Garter, in 1916. Thousands of signatures and recent protests by Belgian people have called for the removal of his statues and the payment of reparations to the victims of the colonial crimes.
The people were clearly being punished for something, but that something was neither negligence nor a crime. Their Belgian masters had decided a certain rubber quota for them to harvest, and they had failed to reach their quota. But it wasn't only these slaves who had to pay for this failure. Let's just say the Belgian punishment system for the Congolese who hadn't met their quota included cutting off the hands and feet of their loved ones. According to statistics, between 10 to 15 million Congolese were killed by King Leopold II during his 23 years of ownership of Congo. And though this number is millions more than the number of those killed in other genocides, few people know about Congo's Holocaust. At the time, this genocide committed by the Belgians slashed Congo's population in half. Imagine that, half of the population gone. But it's best to hear about all of this from one of our guests today, who is a historian specializing in colonialism in Africa.
Brothomeo Gabriel is an activist and a member of an anti-colonialist imperialist organization called No White Saviors in Uganda. He specializes in African history, and with the organization, they have opened a Pan-African library in Kampala. He's also a social media expert and uses this specialty to educate the masses about the true history of Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Can you talk about the legacy of the Belgian king, King Leopold II, that legacy that he had on Congo?
we first have to highlight how, unlike other colonies or unlike other entities that were classified as colonies, Leopold classified the Congo as a private property. It's vast land that had people on it, that had resources, that had landscapes and animals, was essentially the private property of one individual. And with that came his self-imposed right to do whatever he saw fit to exploit the people of the land however he saw fit. And the fact that it was private property meant that even the Belgian government, if I may say, at that time, all the Belgian political bodies didn't have a right to dictate or to interfere in whatever decision he took. And we see that with this came a reign of terror for the Congolese people, for the Congolese, Rwandan, and Burundian people. Because when we often talk about the Congo talk about Belgium, we often leave out the fact that Rwanda and Burundi also faced similar atrocities at the hands of the Belgians.
I mean, it's estimated up to 15 million Congolese were killed during Leopold's reign. Do you think that these numbers are accurate?
It could have possibly been more than 15 million. I'm one of the people who believe it was more than 15 million because when you look at the systemic situation as it was, the fact that for every hand that was chopped, it had to be accounted for. Every bullet that was fired had to be accounted for. So that meant taking back the arms of the victim, or the hands of the victim, back to the force public officials. I think that's how the force was referred to at that time. I'm not quite good with my French isn't quite good. But you see that the institutional or systemic system as it was at that point promoted violence against Congolese people. For any small thing, you could have fallen short on your rubber collection and, you know, your child would pay the price or your family member would pay the price. Even you yourself would pay the price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, there are cries by the Congolese population to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people, that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act, only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo-sense of, we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. So many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery. The oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being 24 trillion dollars. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper, copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands in unsafe mines. And it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects as a result of this dangerous hands-on approach to cobalt harvest. And yet, in 2018, over 70% of the Congolese lived on less than $1.90 a day. Clearly, even though their country is no longer the private property of a Belgian king, they continue to have little to no share in their rich national resources. But how is this happening today in what's now called the DRC, or the Democratic Republic of Congo? Our next guest has some interesting answers, so let's find out more.
Tede Kofi is a broadcast journalist with credits on the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 5, where he presented Current Affairs magazine programs. Tet is a newspaper publisher and ran the Ethnic Media Group, publishing Asian and Afro-Caribbean titles. He has been a crisis, media coach, and consultant for multinational corporations, specializing in the arena of diversity management.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. We appreciate you being with us today on the program. I want your assessment of the effects of Leopold Reign you think could have had on the overall psyche of the Congolese.
The barbarity, the savagery, and the cruelty that Leopold II wreaked on the Congo is one of the world's best-kept secrets. It is estimated that 10 million Congolese died, that he reduced the population of the country by about 70%. In the early days of Leopold, each Congolese man, able-bodied man, was supposed to produce 15 kilograms of rubber per day. If he did not produce that, his family would be rounded up, herded, and killed. And so if people didn't produce their quota, their hands were amputated. There were these bizarre scenes of people presenting like strings of male genitalia, Congolese male genitalia, just to show how many people that they had killed that day because they hadn't made their quota. Now, all of this was covered up by Leopold as an exercise in civilizing the savages, which we Africans were presented as. So he said that basically in the Congo Free State, which is basically my private fiefdom, I've gone over there to introduce them to God and Christianity. And of course, the missionaries were under dire admonitions never to reveal the truth, which of course ultimately leaked, because as slavery was abolished elsewhere, people started to ask questions about how Leopold was running this enterprise. And of course, the whole thing blew up in his face. And he then had to resort to burning all the national records to try and cover up and hide a genocide, which was, you know, in plain view. So again, this is another way in which, if you have lived through that kind of, let me call it a Holocaust, it's probably the greatest human genocide kind of in living memory. If you've been through that kind of genocide, the idea is to instill in the people obedience to authority and power.
How is it, though, that the exploitation of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still existing today, has taken place for so long a period of time?
The oldest playbook in the oldest, sorry, method in the playbook of any totalitarian or any controller is divide and rule. Divide and rule requires that because there are few of the abusers, you must get the people you are abusing to fight each other. As long as they are fighting each other, they cannot unite, because it is only when they are united that they can kick you out of your position of authority, command, and control. And so it is that Congo has always been destabilized by foreign powers and foreign interests who have a profound desire, but whose lifestyles are determined by the cheapness with which they can extract the strategic minerals that I listed before.
Right.
And so that is how it's played out for the Congo. And another way is to make sure that you have proxy governments which are propped up by foreign powers, doing essentially the bidding of the foreign powers, so that they can be the natural and easy exfiltration of the nation's wealth to the benefit of the foreign powers. So that's how it's always played. Divide and rule. Proxy governments, which are created by the foreign powers, and thus it has been to this very day. In fact, now there is another challenge, because colonialism moved to another stage when, by using local agents, the destabilization could be maintained. And even now, if you speak to any Congolese, they will tell you that the role of Rwanda is a very difficult one in their country. And many Congolese blame a lot of the conflicts, internal conflicts within the country, on the actions not only of the Rwandese, but also of the Ugandans.
Well, why haven't we seen reparations for the Congolese after all of this suffering that they have gone through?
For a crime to be expunged, you need recognition that the crime happened, you need regret for the crime happening, and you need recompense. Now, in terms of recognition of the crime happening, my goodness, if you ask anybody what comes out of Congo, what they'll tell you is Makalele, Vincent Kompany, Lualua, and Romelu Lukaku. They're top football players. Most people in the world don't even know what the history of the Congo is beyond some trite superficial modernities. In terms of regret, when the tooth of Patrice Lumumba was handed back to his family, here is the thing. There was no official apology, either on behalf of the Belgian state or on behalf of Leopold II, who committed most of those atrocities. So there is no regret there. And as for compensation, well, Congo's wealth is still being filched out of the country on a daily basis. And the parties who benefit from this are absolutely adamant about the maintenance of their profits. So it's a perfect storm for Africa's richest country. And you've got to think about the bigger picture as well. When Nkrumah stood up in Ghana, the independence of Africa was signaled. When Lumumba stood up in the Congo, the independence of the Congo was signaled. And the thing about these things is that they attract people who follow the cause. And so it is important in the interest of the controlling powers that Congo doesn't become as wealthy as she can be. What if then she starts supporting the rest of the other African countries, and then the yoke of colonialism will be broken one by one by one across the continent? If you want to defeat an enemy, you first defeat their champion, and Congo can be the champion of Africa. Just indeed, as Muammar Gaddafi could have been the champion of Africa. Look what happened to him.
Well, what is it going to take, in your perspective, to turn around the fate of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
All I can say is that if people are severely abused over a long period of time, it takes time for these people to heal, for them to find their center, and to make demands based on their own self-validation. So that work has to take place. But that work has to take place right now in the face of overwhelming media coverage, which makes sure that the only things people associate Congo with is Claude Makélélé and Victor Kompany, football players. People don't know outside of Africa the value and the condition of Congo. So all of this applies very, very negative pressure. On the other hand, the international community must write a new set of rules. And that set of rules should mean that all people, as said in the United Nations Charter, deserve respect and recognition. But at the moment, you know, the world is run by what one cartoonist called the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And so as long as you've got this sort of moral relativism, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Tete Kufi. Appreciate it. But when we talk about the advancement of technology, we often think of prestigious universities and creative minds. Unfortunately, we rarely remember the suffering of hands without whose harvest the main ingredients of advancement would be missing. Hands like those of the Congolese that were cut off for the sake of rubber and the harvest of cobalt. The pain must be acknowledged and the price be paid. But from the Belgian monarchy that has brought about the genocide of the Congolese to the international corporations and various countries that continue to profit from the toil of the Congolese and the taking away of their resources, no entity has acknowledged the crime committed against these people, let alone apologize. Yet even a formal apology can hardly ever appease the victims of such horrible crimes. What good would an apology have done, for instance, the Congolese man who had to stare in shock at the severed body parts of his 5-year-old daughter? I can't even begin to imagine. Well, a true apology must be followed by a change in actions and in reparations, such as those that has for decades been paid by German citizens to those related to victims of Nazi atrocities. Perhaps someday soon, the oppressed nations of the world will begin to have the power to extract this apology from colonial powers of the past and present. But this power requires knowledge. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.